This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. It's the Health and Living Show on The Bigger Picture. I'm Meera Sivasothi. In the third part of the year-end roundup of 2015, we're exploring vaccination and immunization. Every last week of April, the world observes World Immunization Week. And this year, however, the public health campaign to raise awareness and increase the rates of immunization against vaccine-preventable diseases seem to be a year-round effort. This as we face a higher percentage of unvaccinated children and vaccine-preventable disease outbreaks in pockets of the local and global population. Among the issues of concern include the halal status of vaccines and its physical and mental side effects. Here's what the experts have to say.
The most serious disease is meningitis, but it's also the rarest. The disease that is the greatest killer is pneumonia. And so the pneumococcus, especially in young children under 5 years of age, gets into your lungs, causes pneumonia, and can cause death. And it's a very serious disease everywhere in the world, in fact. It's very prevalent pretty much every part of the world. And the important part is, depending on where you are in the world, the seriousness of the outcome can change depending on the healthcare system. So in the poorest countries of the world, in sub-Saharan Africa, for example, pneumonia is the number one cause of death in babies. And so it's the number one disease that we can prevent with a vaccine. And that's what makes the pneumococcal vaccine so important in that part of the world. And sometimes we're a victim of our own success, where we have good programs with our vaccines. We don't see diseases for a long time. And then we start getting neglectful about keeping the immunization rates high and preventing those diseases.
For polio, our last polio case was in 1992. We have 3 cases and all of them were imported. Since 2000, we were announced to have been successfully eradicate polio together with other countries in the Western Pacific region. As for measles, for the last 3 years, it shows the increasing trend. Actually, many factors contributing to the increased numbers of measles cases. The low vaccination coverage in certain areas, influx of migrants, especially from Myanmar, and because we have better surveillance in the system, because actually Malaysia is going towards elimination of measles. So when we have better surveillance, we detect more cases.
If you look at the United States, where there is monitoring, it has caused a drop of 94% over 5 years of invasive pneumococcal disease with the introduction of pneumococcal vaccine in the NIP, or the National Immunization Program, in America. So you've got to have this core number of about 80 to 92% of the population that's vaccinated, and then you get this effect of reduction of invasive pneumococcal disease. At the same time, there was also a drop in the people who were not vaccinated by about 60%. Of the older people who were not given the vaccine.
The other thing I think it's worth bringing up is the success with Australia, because Australia started its vaccination program with the Gardasil back in 2007. And within 5 years, they had a 92% drop in new cases of genital warts. It's data that's published, and not only that, what happened is they saw the effects of herd immunity. So the men that were not vaccinated, there was also a drop seen in men who had female partners that were vaccinated. They are now talking about the possibility of eliminating genital warts in Australia.
Generally, people think that you need to get up to about 70% vaccination in terms of vaccinating the carrier in order to see that societal effect. It has to be enough of the people who spread the disease to actually stop that transmission. But if you get to 70%, you'll do a good job. But if you get to 90%, then you'll do a much better job. The higher you get, the more you protect those who are not vaccinated.
Immunization is both a personal form of protection as well as society. When you vaccinate enough people, this group of people form a herd of vaccinated individuals, and they in turn confer what is termed as herd immunity. Because when disease can't enter a particular community, then those who have not received the vaccine for whatever reason will indirectly be protected against the disease as well. For example, whooping cough. If all of the children in a particular play school is vaccinated, and in a particular family is vaccinated, then a newborn baby who is too young to receive the vaccine will indirectly be protected as well, because those who come into contact with the baby will not be carrying the virus. The same thing with rubella. I think most of us are familiar with rubella and congenital rubella syndrome. If the mother is vaccinated and the mother has antibodies, then the baby will be protected in the womb. But if the mother does not have the antibodies for whatever reason and comes into contact with a child or an adult who has active rubella, there is a possibility that that fetus in the womb may be born blind, deaf, mentally retarded and with heart problem, because the infection has managed to reach the child. But if everyone had received the vaccine, then the possibility of a child getting the disease and coming into contact with this mother will be minimal, and that fetus in the womb will thus be protected. When you are immunizing someone, it means you are trying to produce immunity. You're trying to get the person to be immune or to be protected against a particular infection. So immunity can be acquired or natural immunity. So we can give active or passive immunity, and we can actually give the vaccine to a patient or person so that he can become immune against the disease. Vaccinations in general is the act of actually giving something to an individual in order to stimulate the body to produce antibodies. And in turn, these antibodies will protect the individual against infection.
It's a process that begins first by understanding the pathogen, understanding either the virus or the bacteria, where it's prevalent, how it spreads, and then more importantly, how you can kill it. You know, in viruses, we say neutralize it. In bacteria, we say kill it. And once you determine the mechanism for doing that, you can decide and learn what the target should be for your vaccine. And there are a number of ways to do that. So sometimes you can take that virus and attenuate it, which means that you make it so that it doesn't cause disease, but will induce an antibody response. And then measles is a good example of that, where you give that vaccine, you don't get measles, but you get immunity. The conjugate vaccines that I've worked on take part of the outside of the bacteria, the polysaccharide, and make that immunogenic, so you can raise antibody to the surface of the bacteria and kill the bacteria. There are different ways to approach vaccines like measles. The measles vaccine that's currently used is called a live attenuated vaccine. It's a measles strain that was isolated and made to be non-disease causing. So you can immunize with it without causing disease. But you could also take a part of that virus and make what's called a subunit vaccine, or take a protein from the surface and use that as a vaccine candidate. That's one possibility, or you could use that in combination with a live. There are a lot of different possibilities for making a more effective vaccine. And I think there are older vaccines. Pertussis is another example, where we went from what was called a whole cell vaccine to an acellular pertussis vaccine that's a little bit less effective and probably needs to be improved. And, you know, it's a balance between going back and working on vaccines that are already reasonably effective and spending your time on diseases for which there is no vaccine at all.
I think people are apprehensive about vaccination. You see things about children getting too many vaccines and too young, their immune system can't cope with it. It is a conspiracy.
If you key in immunization or vaccination on the internet, you find the first 10 or 20 websites are actually anti-vaccine websites, and you will see from the content, the titles will be something that sounds very authoritative, but when you read the content, you know that something is not right. But people who don't have the kind of knowledge and the kind of background that maybe medical personnel or people who are more knowledgeable will tend to believe what they read. It's actually important that you make statements that are based on facts. And we are actually concerned about the anti-vaccine lobbies, because basically what we've done over the past few decades in reducing vaccine-preventable diseases is now overturned just because of the social media and a lot of buzz going around talking about the dangers of vaccination. We're concerned. The uptake is decreasing. We're getting outbreaks, you know, so, and I think parents need to know that.
One of the things that people cite for not wanting to give vaccines is that vaccines contain mercury. That is not true today. All single-dose vaccines do not contain mercury.
Actually, vaccine adjuvant or preservative in it, because this is unavoidable for some vaccine production. Because preservatives are used in some vaccines to ensure the stability of the vaccine and to prevent bacterial and fungal growth. So commonly used preservatives is Tamiflu, which contain what we call mercury, called ethyl mercury. But this ethyl mercury does not have any neurotoxic effect. And the amount used in vaccine is very, very small, and it has been used for more than 8 years and without any evidence of being harmful. And as for certain adjuvants are added to the vaccine to enhance the immune response to the vaccine. And most commonly used adjuvant is aluminium salt, which is also known as alum. But as you know, that aluminium is available in our daily diet and also medications such as antacids. So the amount in the vaccine is very much low as compared to our daily intake. For formaldehyde is a byproduct of vaccine production. Formaldehyde is used during the manufacture of some vaccines to inactivate viruses such as polio and hepatitis A, and to inactivate some bacterial toxins like diphtheria and tetanus toxin. But during the process, formaldehyde is purified away and only very small quantities remain. Actually, formaldehyde is also a byproduct in our body through DNA synthesis and also byproduct of protein metabolism. So it is in our bloodstream actually.
Secondly, they say that vaccines contain cells of aborted fetuses. Vaccines today are produced in the labs.
Actually, fetal cells are used to make these viruses grow during the manufacturing process. But it is a one-off thing which is taken from a fetus elective abortion performed somewhere in 1960s. And after that, no further abortion is necessary to culture all these viruses, because these viruses can multiply by itself. So there are actually several reasons why scientists choose fetal cells. Basically, because the viruses require cell to grow. So this is the best cell. And fetal cells are different from other type of cells in that they are virtually immortal. So that's why we can use the aborted fetal cell in 1960s until now.
In Malaysia, according to JAKIM, some of the vaccines have been classified as haros, and basically that's permissible. I think there's only one that's actually stated as haram. Right? So from a religious standpoint, okay, I'm a Muslim, all right, and from a religious standpoint, I would be sinning if I actually give the vaccine that I consider haram. And I have looked at all the vaccines. There's no issue with any of the vaccines as far as the ingredients are concerned. And I give it. Most of my patients are actually Muslim patients. I explain to them there's no issue with any of the vaccines.
Thirdly, they say that it is better for a child to get the infection themselves, because if you were to feed them the infection, then they become weaker. They should learn to fight. Well, there's some truth in that, but if you allow a child to fight an infection, there is a possibility the child might not recover. Are we then going to say survival of the fittest? Do we not want our children to grow up into adulthood? Do we not protect them when they want to cross the road? Do we not wear seatbelts when we drive our cars and place them in car seats? Oh no, they don't always do that. Do we not want to keep our children safe? And this is one way of actually training. It's just like giving mock exams before the real exam. You see, you give them small doses so that the body can build a resistance, so that should they have the misfortune of being challenged by a particular infection, if they already have had previous exposure in minute doses through vaccines, they are thus well protected and they will not succumb to that infection.
The child's system, the immune system, is capable of actually taking up a lot more than what we're giving in the vaccines. And, you know, if we give a total of, say, 12 antigens at the moment, there's no issue with the immune system. And the cells will replenish itself anyway.
It has been ascertained that vaccines do not cause autism. Secondly, we do not pump a syringe full enough for a horse into a child. It's 0.5 ml only. And even if we were to give combination vaccine, the volume does not exceed 0.5 mL. In most cases, the child will scream at the point of injection, but that's short-lived. They may get a bit of tenderness, redness. Some, but not all, vaccines may cause fever or rashes, but there are no major side effects that I've seen over 20 years of practice. When we look at human rights, many parents say that it is the right of the parents to decide whether or not to administer a particular vaccine on the child. But what about the rights of the child to live free of disease, to live free of fear of dying of a communicable disease? I think that child has a right too. And what about the right of the fetus to be born without any deformities just because the mother was exposed to another child with rubella? I think it is the child's right to be born with sight and hearing and a normal heart and normal IQ. And all this will be robbed from him should the mother come into contact with a child with rubella, especially if the mother herself is not immune. So I think rights does not only just cover that of the parents, but also that of the child and the community at large.
I think parents can make decision for their own children, but when that decision affects other children, then we as guardian of our population need to take some sort of action to protect the greater population. So, you know, we saw what happened in Disneyland where the measles broke out. And in Australia, we've seen cases such as that as well, where there's measles that have affected children. And so I think it's right to take some sort of action to protect the greater good.
Once you get the immunization below that threshold amount, it's for pneumococcus 92, but for other diseases, if you get less than 90, then you will have pockets of outbreaks, and those pockets will then spread around the same area, and you have then a small epidemic. And you know, we used to have these sort of things in the past, in the last few cases of diphtheria. And this was in a religious community that refused to have vaccinations. If you have a case of diphtheria, it's enough to remind you that vaccination is important. The problem is the rest of the population have never seen diphtheria. Because of this refusal or hesitancy, now we have to be more vigilant about the cases that come in to see us. You know, instead of going further and looking at non-communicable diseases, looking at other things that are more important, now we have to go back and start looking at infections, which we should have left behind a long time ago.
And I think this is important. If you have concerns, I think you should go speak to a pediatrician and ask them.
But don't just discuss amongst yourselves and come up with hypotheses. I've heard a lot of hypotheses. And when I ask for the source, it is merely conjured from a group of individuals discussing about a potential side effect. It's just like saying, if I do this, this happens. What if this were to be done? You know, without actually looking at the scientific evidence. And then they postulate and they come up with a theory, and after theorizing, they put it as a post on social media, and then it goes viral. It becomes the gospel truth.
There are different vaccines that are not covered by the government, which you are recommended to have. So there are other vaccines like meningococcal vaccine, pneumococcal, flu vaccines.
Decision to introduce new vaccines to the National Immunization Program is made by the National Committee on Policy and Practice for Immunization, which is chaired by our DG. So the committee consists of experts in various areas, including pediatricians, physicians, virologists, immunologists, as well as public health specialists. So a proposal to introduce new vaccines can come from organizations or departments. This proposal will be presented to the technical committee, and the committee also will review the proposal before it be presented to the national committee. So the revision includes the disease burden, the related vaccine, the efficacy and safety of the vaccine, and the cost effectiveness in introducing the new vaccine into the system, and also the availability of systems to support the new program, as well as the funds to ensure that the sustainability of the new vaccine. Since the committee been actively convened every year, We have introduced HPV vaccine, and in the pipeline, we also presented pneumococcal vaccine, but we're still looking for more information, local data, before we can introduce the vaccine. Because we need to have money, which is usually given by the Ministry of Finance, before we can introduce the program, because we want to ensure that we can sustain the program. These committees advise on the immunization schedule, is based on literatures and experience in other countries, because the schedule set must provide best immune response to our children to ensure that they are protected against the diseases.
If you have one success with a vaccine, which means that you get through the process, you put it into babies, and then you watch a disease go away, it doesn't get much better than that, I'll tell you. It's a very powerful medical tool, and if you can accomplish it, then you're doing some real good. And so when you see that happen, if you're working in the lab or you're working in the clinic, it inspires you to keep going.
Vaccination saves lives, not vaccines save life, because vaccines kept on the shelf is not going to save lives. It's vaccination that saves lives. What we're trying to do is actually trying to put the message across that vaccination is important. And we've got a program that's actually initiated by the Ministry of Health, and it's with the Malaysian Pediatric Association as well as the Malaysian Society for Infectious Disease and Chemotherapy. And it's called the Immunize for Life program. There's a website called www.ifl.my, which people can log into and find out about all vaccines, as well as from the basics to individual vaccines. And that's a ministry initiative in trying to get that message across.
Join me tomorrow in our penultimate episode of the Year End Roundup. We'll discuss a hot topic that picked up quite a bit of steam in the news this year. Vaping. I'm Mira Sivasuthi, and you've been listening to Health and Living on the Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.